from the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KVCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. The Supreme Court has temporarily blocked a citizenship question on the 2020 census, but will that stand? Meanwhile, the justices have okayed drawing legislative districts based on partisanship. How could that change political maps and election outcomes in 2020? Speaking of 2020, we'll break down the debate last night, all coming up after this news. Thanks for listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KVCC. I'm Libby Denkman. Larry Mantle is on vacation. He'll be back on Monday. The Supreme Court has waited until the very end of the term to drop two highly consequential decisions for democracy in this country. First, should states be allowed to draw gerrymandered legislative districts based on partisan motivations? And second, when the census arrives at people's doorsteps or inboxes, as it will in 2020, will there be a question about citizenship on that survey? The conclusions the justices came to in these cases are pretty darn complicated. Luckily, we have a highly skilled Supreme Court whisperer on the line for us right now. Amy Howe is co-founder of SCOTUS Blog and author of the blog Howe on the Court. That's Howe with an E. And she tweets at A Howe Blogger. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for being here today. Of all days, I need you today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I know you were reading these furiously and keeping everybody informed on the SCOTUS blog account. I was watching as you guys were sort of breaking everything down as these rulings came out. First, can we start with the census ruling? What do you read into what the justices said?
The census ruling was really kind of remarkable. You know, the Chief Justice was joined by the court's former liberal justices in saying, in essence, you know, you're going to need a do-over because you told us that you wanted this question about citizenship on the census to better enforce federal voting rights laws. And we don't believe that that's, when we look at the evidence, we don't believe you. And so we're going to send it back for a do-over and you're going to have to provide a better explanation. And so it's not really, it's fascinating because it's not really clear what's going to happen from here. The Trump administration had urged the justices to decide this case quickly. They said we need an answer by the end of June so that we can finalize the census questionnaire and go ahead and get the forms printed. They need, you know, to print something like 100 million census questionnaires. And so it's not really clear what's going to happen going forward. Are they going to try and provide an explanation now and go ahead and try and include the citizenship question after all? And is there going to be another court challenge over the summer? It's, you know, we're kind of in uncharted waters here.
I mean, this ruling seemed to really blast Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross for the reasoning that he gave to the justices for wanting this census to have a citizenship question. Elena Kagan said during oral arguments that it appeared he was shopping around for a need for the citizenship question. He first went to the Justice Department and then he went to DHS and back to the Justice Department, according to Kagan's reading of it. And then Secretary Ross finally came up with this justification, which was he argued that they needed it to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Was that the central problem here, that justices just didn't buy this was about the Voting Rights Act?
Exactly. They sort of marched through the evidence and they didn't actually use the phrase shopping around. But as I read the opinion, that was exactly the phrase from the oral argument that came to my mind. They said, you said that you wanted to do this because the Department of Justice had asked for the data, but that is sure not what we think when we look at the evidence. And they sort of went through the whole history of how immediately after the inauguration, they started looking for, talking about wanting to include the question on the census and started looking for a way to do it. And when you look at it this way, it sure doesn't look like the reason that you gave matches up with the actual reasons. And they said, you know, normally courts are very deferential to federal administrative agencies when they give a reason. But, you know, as a law professor I used to work with would say, you know, we were born at night, but we weren't born last night. So now, so the, you know, it's a defeat for the Trump administration, at least temporarily, and we'll kind of have to see what happens next.
And this was also a constitutional issue, wasn't it? I mean, there was a requirement, at least advocates of keeping that question off said that the Constitution requires counting not just citizens, but everyone in the country every 10 years. But it sounds like this really hinged on administrative procedure and not on a constitutional question. Am I reading that right, Amy?
That's exactly right. The Constitution, the enumerations clause, which requires an actual enumeration of the population, it's where we get the requirement for the census, was also an issue. And there wasn't really, there wasn't a dispute, really, for all intents and purposes in the Supreme Court about that. The Supreme Court said that passes muster. We're going to focus on whether or not this is what we call pretextual, whether or not the justification that was given for the, whether or not the excuse matches up with the actual reason, and we don't think it does.
We're talking with Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS blog and author of the blog Howe on the Court, Howe with an E. So right now, Amy, what that means is that Wilbur Ross and the Commerce Department can go and find another reasoning, find a clearer motive for why they need the citizenship question, and they can present it again to the courts. But in the meantime, we have this actual physical real life printing need that has to happen, a deadline that's been set as July 1st was the earlier date that I saw, as you mentioned. But if the forms go out and the printing is accomplished, by the time Wilbur Ross has actually gotten a chance to come up with his justification, that ship may already have sailed, right?
Right. And that's what's so unclear, that, you know, the sort of the things were reversed very recently. You know, the challengers in the case had been trying to get the Supreme Court to send this case back down to the district court in New York so that the district court could consider new evidence that was found in the files of this Republican redistricting strategist from North Carolina. And they said that evidence shows that the actual reason that the Commerce Department wanted to include this question on the census was to put whites and Republicans at an advantage in future elections. And they said there's plenty of time to do this because an expert from the Census Bureau has testified that as long as they have some more money, the Census Department actually doesn't need to start printing the forms until October 31st. As long as they start by Halloween, they're fine. And the government insisted that it needed to start, needed to finalize the census by June 30th. So the government has put itself in a little bit of a bind. And then the other bind is, you know, having... with all of this evidence, you know, it's not clear what reason now they would offer to explain why they want to add the citizenship question. I mean,
if the Voting Rights Act wasn't good enough, you're saying what else would be a better reason?
Right, and it sort of in light of the process that they went through, where they sort of had the decision to add the citizenship question in search of a justification, And there may well be one. Maybe I'm just being a little bit too cynical here. There may well be one, and we'll get a better sense perhaps of what the government might be intending to do. The government is also litigating another case involving the citizenship question in a federal district court in Maryland, and it's supposed to file something tonight in that case. So that judge has reopened the case so that he can look at the new evidence from the North Carolina redistricting specialist's files. And the government is supposed to file something in that case by 8:00 tonight. So maybe we'll get a hint about what the government might be doing next. It's all a little bit murky right now.
It is murky, and it seems to leave a lot of questions open. I never thought that so much would ride on the quickness with which we can simply print out forms. I mean, I'm reading in the New York Times about the last census 10 years ago, the fact that nearly every printing business in the country that could accomplish this complicated job was employed by the Census Bureau for a time in order to get those out.
Paper. It's a lot of trees.
It's wild, yeah. Even though there will be more of an online component this time around. Amy Howe, you know, finally, you know, before we move to this gerrymandering case, the issue of this new evidence, it didn't really appear in the current decision that we have out from the court this morning, right? That wasn't really part of what the justices handed down today.
That's correct. You know, it was not before the justices. It didn't come out until late May that the justices were first notified, and there had been sort of dueling filings even as recently as last night relating to various developments arising from the new evidence. But the justices sort of took pains to make clear that this was just based on the evidence even in the record of the case, that sort of the events leading up to the decision to include the record, to include the citizenship question.
And I want to move to the gerrymandering decision now, because I heard that there was some emotion in the courtroom. You were at the court for the decisions today. Amy Howe with me. You can read all her analysis of the Supreme Court and a wonderful blog that she keeps up called Howe on the Court. And she also tweets at A Howe Blogger. Amy, what did you observe in this political gerrymandering decision? What did the court decide, and how did they come to that decision?
So this was the second time in two terms that the Supreme Court had cases involving partisan gerrymandering before it. Last term, there were two cases, one of which actually made a reappearance this term. And the Supreme Court last term, to use the term that we use in the press room, punted. You know, they didn't actually get to the merits of either case. And so that the issue was back, and there were two basic questions before the Supreme Court. The first one is whether or not courts can and should get involved in partisan gerrymandering claims at all, or whether or not instead it's something that should be left to the political process. And then the second question was, you know, if courts do get involved, you know, how are courts supposed to decide these kinds of cases? And in the end, it was a little bit less complicated, a little bit easier to read than the census case. That by a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court, also in a decision by the Chief Justice John Roberts, ruled that courts should not get involved in partisan gerrymandering claims. They called it a political question that should be left to the political process. They said that political gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, some partisan gerrymandering is something that, you know, it's something that's been going on for a long time. It's something that is accepted. Everybody accepts that when legislatures are drawing maps for the state legislature or for Congress, of course they're going to consider party affiliation to a certain degree. Everyone, you know, agrees that's acceptable. And the question really when you're talking about partisan gerrymandering is, when does it cross the line? When do the drawers of the maps consider partisan affiliation too much so that it becomes unconstitutional? And what the Chief Justice, in his opinion for the court, said, he was joined by the court's other more conservative justices, is that it's really like almost impossible to come up with a standard to figure out when partisan gerrymandering crosses the line and becomes unconstitutional. And for that reason, the courts are going to have to stay out of it. Justice Elena Kagan, he acknowledged that, you know, partisan gerrymandering is distasteful, that it can produce results that many people aren't going to like. He said, you know, that the fact that courts aren't going to get involved in it doesn't mean that there aren't other options to check partisan gerrymandering. He said that the states can continue to take action to check partisan gerrymandering. Congress can take action to try to fight partisan gerrymandering, including, for example, by requiring states to have independent redistricting commissions so that you've got a group of citizens, perhaps even experts on voting rights, and they will have, for example, you know, five Democrats, five Republicans, and five independents drawing maps. The idea is that you take the party affiliation out of the redistricting process.
Sure. We have that system in California now.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, Amy, when we look at how this decision was come to historically, the question was always about this test, as you mentioned, that the justices could never quite grapple with what will the test be
right.
to say this is too partisan and, you know, this is okay to allow this gerrymandering. And we all, you know, people who paid any attention to the court saw that kind of struggle as Anthony Kennedy was getting ready to resign, whether or not Kennedy would finally say, okay, this is a test that's good enough. We can actually make a ruling on partisan gerrymandering. You know, were you surprised to see the courts take this on and finally officially say it's not our job? How do you feel about seeing a conclusion in this question that was sort of open for many, many years?
You know, I'm not really surprised. You know, the Supreme Court had really been struggling with this. And, you know, John Roberts, this clearly seemed like where he had been heading for a long time. And so, you know, after last term, when they didn't decide the merits of the case, there didn't seem to be a lot of options for the Supreme Court this term to decide these cases, you know, in a way that, you know, any sort of off-ramp, to decide these cases in a way that allowed them to avoid the question of whether or not this is something that courts should have a role in doing. And, you know, I'm not at all surprised that with the five more conservative justices on the court now, that this was how it played out. You know, the Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, two of the court's newer justices, were definitely asking questions at the oral argument along the lines of, you know, isn't this something that, you know, that independent redistricting commissions and Congress can take care of? Do we really need to step in now?
Yeah, yeah. And Amanda, Amy, we're just running out of time here. I thank you so much for being here, always being such a good resource for Air Talk when we're trying to tackle these really difficult questions of Supreme Court decisions, especially on a day like today. Again, the census question temporarily blocked by the Supreme Court, which may effectively mean it will stay off the 2020 census, still open to challenge by the Commerce Department. And as Amy Howe just explained, gerrymandering, political gerrymandering, allowed by the Supreme Court. Court said it's not our job to decide. It's a legislative issue. Again, Howe on the court, if you want to follow Amy's coverage, and at A Howe Blogger, Howe with an E. Thanks again for being here, Amy. And we're going to be digging into the consequences of these rulings later in the show. Also coming up, the 2020 Democrats on the stage last night, not a lot of talk about justices or appointing judges, but I have a feeling that's going to change for the second debate that's rolling out in Miami. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today, back after this short break. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Last night in Miami, we saw some sharp elbows and a lot of candidates jockeying for airtime. You'll have to forgive them. It was their first big chance to grab the attention of Democratic voters on a national stage. The 2020 Democratic candidates had several recurring themes: economic fairness, expanding health care coverage, reforming immigration policy, and building a green economy. One thing we didn't hear too much about: the occupant of the White House or the Democratic candidate sitting atop the polls right now, Joe Biden. Let's get into that with our panel. Amanda Renteria is with us, chair of Emerge America, a national organization that works to identify and train Democratic women who want to run for political office. And she's the former national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Amanda, thanks so much for being here. And I first want to start with these consequential Supreme Court decisions. Do you have a take on especially that gerrymandering case, what it means for our democratic system going forward?
Well, I think it's interesting. I actually here in Miami and went out to visit the Homestead Detention Center. And interestingly, while I was there is when the news came in from all the news outlets who are right outside the detention center. And the first one comes in talking about the gerrymandering, and then the census decision came in. And I think the way I think about it is everyone will be counted, but now the question will be what will happen within that voting process. And so, for as I think about it, and I think about the way campaigns work and the way, we've really thought through how we get votes out, I think it's really dangerous to think about leaving it up to a partisan system. And so my hope is that we're going to talk to states and localities around the country and talk about why it's so important for our democracy that it is a fair process.
Yeah. Matt Rodriguez is in the studio with me, Democratic strategist and founder and chief executive officer of Rodriguez Strategies. He's also a former senior Obama advisor in 2008. Matt, what did you make of the rulings, the census decision? It looks like there's a reprieve on adding that citizenship question, but the gerrymandering case, meaning a lot of places in that don't have independent redistricting commissions, may see quite a few lines that are drawn based purely on political motives.
Well, that all depends on where your perspective comes down on how the system should work, right? And so you have basically the argument is that, look, this is a political system that we're in. And so at one level, it's like, we can't leave this up to the political process, but it by definition is a political process.
Yeah, real talk, this is politics.
That's the deal. And so I think a lot of that issue depends on where your ox is getting gored, right? If you're in California, you like the fact that Democrats have pretty favorably drawn seats and the fact that they are gaining seats continually throughout over the course of the last 20 years. If you're in a state, if you're a Democrat in a state like Texas or Alabama, you're probably not going to be quite as happy about it. So a lot of, I think, people's positions on that particular issue is where you're, which ox is being gored. And if you're in California, you're pretty happy if you're a Democrat. And if you're in the Deep South, you might be a little bit sketchier if the makeup of the state legislature is not favorable to your party. But it's a huge deal because gerrymandering has become a large issue, and you saw Obama and Eric Holder. They've also been looking at trying to make some of the process more fair, whatever they consider more fair. So this is a big win for folks who believe this should be in the political process and not sort of giving over to a bureaucratic or a judicial type of system.
Sean T. Walsh with us as well, Republican political analyst and partner at Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, former advisor to Governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Sean, your take, the Supreme Court, big, big rulings handed down this morning. First impressions.
It's not a surprise to see the court come down the way they did with regards to redistricting. The point was made by Mr. Roberts that the states have the ability to set up their own fair processes. In California, way back when I was in Governor Wilson's administration, the districts were out of whack. And so what we did was we set up a panel of retired judges to go out and look at the districts and put forward a recommendation for fair and balanced districts that represented the individuals that they served. And they came up with that solution. And I think that's in many respects what John Roberts looked at. The states have the capacity to do that, number one. And number two, that it's not the responsibility of the courts to be a overarching political, taskmaster for the states. It's up for the states to figure that out on their own.
Moving on to what everybody is assembled here today to talk about, the debates that were in Miami last night. I was, counting the number of times I think judges or judicial appointments came up. I think it was like 1.5, maybe 2. But I have a feeling that is really going to change this evening. Sean, staying with you, what were your first impressions of the Democratic slate that was before us, half of the Democratic candidates? I know that you are somebody who's been an advisor to Republicans in the past. What's your take on the potential competition going forward?
Well, people have called this the junior varsity debate, and it's probably right insofar as where everybody stands in the polls. Warren went into the night being the front runner. She left the night being the front runner. She was given the position literally in the debate, front and center. So I don't think really much changed from my perspective. Julian Castro probably helped himself a bit. Cory Booker helped himself a little bit. The rest of them did not do really much to move the needle at all. And Warren didn't step on anything. And she was happy to get her opening comments in on the economy and then basically fade into mostly oblivion for the rest of the debate.
One big question I had going into last night was whether we would see Elizabeth Warren distinguish herself further from Bernie Sanders. She's been eating away at his poll numbers a bit in the standings, you know, early polls. So take that for what it's worth. Amanda, do you think that Elizabeth Warren used her opportunity last night to provide some daylight between herself and other candidates? Do you think she had to do that last night?
I don't think she had to do that. I think what she did is exactly what she's been doing, and we've seen her on the trail do the same thing, which is really present herself she's the woman with the plan, but not just that, connecting her plan to her stories, her perspectives, her experiences, and making it tangible for folks. And she did do that last night. And I thought that's really, you know, as she came in as the highest polling candidate, that was really her job to do that. And then you did see that the whole rest of the field really didn't attack her, so there wasn't a back and forth for her to do more than that. And so I think she did what she needed to do last night.
They attacked Beto instead. At least that was the ones that stood out. Matt Rodriguez here in studio. I want to take a listen really quick and get your take on the question that was asked about healthcare and whether you supported a single-payer system that would eliminate private healthcare. Elizabeth Warren has been a co-sponsor of the Medicare for All plan that Bernie Sanders has put forward. Here she is talking about why and whether she supports Bernie's plan.
I'm with Bernie on Medicare for All, and let me tell you why. I've spent a big chunk of my life studying why families go broke. And one of the number one reasons is the cost of health care, medical bills. And that's not just for people who don't have insurance. It's for people who have insurance. Look at the business model of an insurance company. It's to bring in as many dollars as they can in premiums and to pay out as few dollars as possible for your health care. Medicare for All solves that problem. And I understand there are a lot of politicians who say, oh, it's just not possible. We just can't do it. It's have a lot of political reasons for this. What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it.
They just won't fight for it. Matt Rodriguez, Elizabeth Warren, and Bill de Blasio, the only candidates on the stage last night who raised their hands saying they would abolish private health care.
Yeah.
What is that going to play like when it comes to a wider Democratic constituency than maybe the progressive wing?
Well, I think you saw there and heard both, I think, the promise and I think the peril of Warren's candidacy. She's very compelling. She knows her issues very well. One of the challenges when you run for president is, do you actually have something to say? And we've got 20 candidates there. And frankly, a lot of them don't really have anything real to say. You can say your talking points about how terrible Trump is and you want to make changes. But at the end of the day, there's really three or four candidates, at least so far, that really have something to say and have a theory of the case. And Warren is benefiting from the fact that she has a very specific theory of the case. She wants to kind of reformulate capitalism, big reformer. She knows the issues better than anybody up there. And even Bernie, who's kind of, you know, Bernie sort of is making a lot of stuff up during the 2016 race. And I've always taken shots at him. And I still believe that. Warren is sort of like Bernie, who's kind of believes in a big vision, but actually knows some of the issues, I think, better than he does. That's all good. The problem with that position on healthcare is that is very appealing in the room. It's very appealing to some activists. But that is going to be hugely disruptive. And you saw a little bit of that when Delaney went after her. Now, he's not going anywhere. But
sure.
He brought up what the problem is going to be, which is, so are you going to shut down these hospitals? How about the 100+ million people who actually like their health care? What are you going to do when you say you're going to lose your health care? And while she's going to come back and say, no, you're going to get covered, that starts to get complicated and dragged down. And look, for a guy who worked for Bill Bradley back in, now this is 20 years ago, so it's a different time. But Al Gore actually attacked him from the right on health care. Bradley was trying to extend health care to folks, and Gore went after him saying it's going to really disrupt the system. It's going to screw things up. You're going to lose health care. Here's all the things you're going to have a problem with. And so while I think Warren showed why she's very competent and very smart and very compelling when she talks about fighting, and that really is going to play early, as this field starts to narrow, she is going to be somewhat vulnerable when you sit there and say, look, I'm going to take a massive part of the U.S. economy and I'm going to throw it up in the air. And that's going to be no matter where people come down substantively, I'm just telling you politically, that's going to be an issue. And it's not just going to be an issue in the general. It will be an issue in the primary at some point. It won't be for a while. She's going to skate for a while, but she won't be come November and December on that issue.
Yeah, I mentioned de Blasio, the other candidate who mentioned he would abolish private health care. I want to play another clip where de Blasio was sort of the sharp elbowed one of the those candidates who is always trying to jump in and get his voice heard in this very crowded field. And he kind of stepped on Beto O'Rourke, who was talking about wanting to maintain the choice of having a health plan through your employer. Here's Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City. And then you'll hear Delaney jumping in, as Matt just mentioned, in the end.
Would you replace private insurance?
No, I think the choice is fundamental our ability to get everybody cared for.
Private insurance is not working for tens of millions of Americans. When you talk about the copays, the deductibles, the premiums, the out-of-pocket expenses, it's not working.
That's right. So for those for whom it's not working, they can choose Medicare. For the culinary workers in Nevada who I listen to,
who negotiated for those plans,
they're able to keep them.
Why are you defending private insurance?
They like their private health insurance, by the way. It should be noted that 100 million Americans. I mean, I think we should be the party that keeps what's working and fixes what's broken. I mean, doesn't that make sense? I mean, we should give everyone in this country health care as a basic human right for free. Full stop.
Amanda, your take on this conversation between keeping private health insurance and the idea that de Blasio really articulated there, which is it's not working for too many people. We got to throw it out and do something better.
I think this is going to be a healthy debate all the way through the primary. And that the fact that it started with such a robust conversation, this isn't going away. And I think you are going to see more of a back and forth, particularly in the primary. I'm not exactly sure we're going to see it tonight, but as this field narrows, don't expect this particular conversation around healthcare to go away, because there's some very strong feelings about what is and isn't working and how to move forward. So for me, hearing and seeing that debate was zero surprise. It was interesting to see Mayor de Blasio do what he did in order to get into the conversation. But again, when you're, you know, this big of a race, you've got to do something in order to break in.
It was pretty interesting to see the different tactics that people use to, get some more airtime. And I want to talk about that coming up next with Mitchell McKinney, who's a professor of communication and director of Political Communications Institute at the University of Missouri. That was Amanda Renteria, president of Emerge America. We're also speaking with Matt Rodriguez, a Democratic strategist, Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh, also in the mix. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're going over the Democratic debate, round one, back after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Air Talk, Libby in for Larry today, going over the Democratic presidential debates. Thanks so much for being with us. Amanda Renteria, president of Emerge America, is part of our panel today, along with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst. Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco is his outfit. Mitchell McKinney joins us now, professor of communication and director of the Political Communications Institute at the University of Missouri. And Mitchell, your research includes presidential debates and rhetoric, political campaigns, everything that has to do with what happened last night. I'm curious if there were points in this debate that we saw with the Democratic candidates that resonated with you in terms of past debates, moments, breakout talking points, anything that reminded you of the history of debates?
Libby, actually, as I listen to the 2 hours, the candidates, and we can chat about some of the moments that your panelists have already noted, one of the things that stood out in this debate was the extent to which this was an issue discussion debate. And much more so if we go back 4 years, particularly on the Republican side, I'll be anxious. I don't know that we've seen the viewership ratings and if the DNC will be able to sustain these two nights in a row, two-hour debates. I think I did see where the president tweeted out that the debate was boring. But again, unlike some past primary debates that really we turn to and we point to various moments where the attacks were more on personal attacks, on character, this very much was an issue discussion driven mainly by those journalists that were putting to the candidates questions that were designed to have them to take a stand to explain to the Democratic voters their position on issues. And then we did see emerge throughout the night. You've mentioned some of these moments, whether it was Castro taking on O'Rourke in terms of immigration law and policy, de Blasio to O'Rourke in terms of the role of private insurers, even the Gabbard and Ryan exchange in terms of should we remain in Afghanistan. We started to see emerge throughout that debate several instances of differentiating positions, candidates, positions, and if you will, the sort of spectrum of differences on some of these important issues, which we generally see as a feature of a face-to-face debate. When we bring the candidates together, we hope that voters will learn more so on issues, and then also start to understand differences. So, in that regard, you know, we may talk about specific individuals that did a stellar job, some who didn't do such a good job, but overall, I thought it was a very informative debate for voters, and it succeeded in what we expect or what we hope will happen in a candidate debate.
You know, I think you're right. It was very issue focused compared to my expectations going in, just knowing there were so many people on the stage. I didn't think they'd be able to get to much policy nuance, and they did a pretty good job, those NBC moderators. One thing that sticks out to me is when they went after Beto on whether he would support a marginal income tax rate on the very wealthy, things that members of his party, some members have supported, but he hasn't come out with a firm answer. I think that they elicited a firm answer from Elizabeth Warren, who had hemmed and hawed in previous forums about whether she would definitely abolish private health insurance. So for you, that was a well-crafted debate, Mitchell McKinney with University of Missouri. You know, anything that sticks out to you in terms of maybe failings that the candidates missed their opportunities last night or missed their opportunity to differentiate themselves?
Well, others have noted, I think, on the panel, Elizabeth Warren did a fine job. I would put Cory Booker and also Julian Castro in that sort of top tier in terms of their performance. The fact that Beto O'Rourke came under more, it seemed more attack in terms of some of these issues that where other candidates on the stage disagreed, put him on really in a defensive position. And then Klobuchar, there was not taking advantage of moments of trying to capitalize on moments to weave a narrative where we might remember as much. Now, of the other half, the others that were on the stage, it is true that de Blasio was more of the interrupter, but the strategy there seemed to be that he realized as one on the flanks on the stage, he had to take control to command time, and he did so, I thought, in a way that drew attention to himself.
Yeah, and drew attention to issues. I mean, he would interject, and some people complained about him yelling on the stage, but truly when he interjected, it did draw out policy differences between himself and other candidates and between the folks on the stage, which I appreciated. I do want to play an exchange. You mentioned Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota. The topic of abortion came up because he's the current governor of Washington, Jay Inslee. My notes here say former, but I'm a Washingtonian by birth, and I know that he's the governor of Washington. He responded to something that he was trying to make a point about was his ability to make change in his state, and that he had passed legislation protecting women's reproductive rights. And Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar really reacted, I think, emotionally to that when Jay Inslee was trying to take credit for all of his work on choice.
And I am the only candidate here who has passed a law protecting a woman's right of reproductive health and health insurance. And I'm the only candidate who has passed a public option. And I respect everybody's goals and plans here. But we do have one candidate that's actually advanced the ball. And we got to have access for everyone. I've done it
your
as a public option.
Senator Klobuchar, I want to give you
a false claim.
I'm fascinated by this, Senator Klobuchar.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. So I'll start with that.
Probably the biggest applause line that I heard for her that night, Amanda Renteria with Emerge America. I think that anytime men start to talk about a women's right to choose when there are, you know, women on the stage, you're walking in some delicate territory, right?
That's right. And especially right now where there's this sisterhood network that really is, you know, happening, right? It wasn't just one woman on the stage. It was three on the stage. And if you notice at the beginning of that debate, the biggest applause lines actually was the first one was when Julian said equal rights amendment and the crowd cheered. And so there was something about sort of really women's issues leaning into that. But it was interesting that at her moment to say something about it, she actually didn't say I, she said we. And that was a real moment for a lot of the women in the audience. You could feel it as you were sitting there, sort of the coming together to sort of say, wait a second, a lot of people have been on the front lines of this.
Yeah, I don't know why Jay Inslee was trying to claim that mantle exactly. I think he should probably stick with his climate change home base issue that he's so passionate about. We are going to talk more with our analysts, Amanda Renteria with Emerge America, Matt Rodriguez of Rodriguez Strategies, Sean T. Walsh with Wilson Walsh Consulting, and Mitchell McKinney of the University of Missouri right after a very short break here on Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. One of the big fights that came out, drew a lot of attention, was Julian Castro going after Beto O'Rourke during the debate in Miami last night about the issue of immigration and a disagreement between Beto and Julian about Section 1325 of the legal code that has to do with criminalizing crossing the border without authorization. And Julian Castro said that he wants to make that a civil penalty. And, you know, when we talked about big, impactful exchanges, I think Julian really succeeded in drawing attention not only to himself, but to his policy ideas in a way that maybe he hadn't been getting that attention before. Matt Rodriguez, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I thought he had a really good night. I personally thought from where I think no one was even thinking about him going into the debate. And I think where he started and where he ended up probably had the biggest, you know, growth or room of anyone. Now, what that means moving forward, I don't know. He still's got a lot of challenges, probably raising money and actually putting together a full blown candidacy. But I was enormously impressed by his policy chops. And Amanda mentioned it earlier. It wasn't just on immigration. He mentioned the Equal Rights Amendment. That was, I think that was a nice way to.
And he mentioned trans rights, which nobody had really mentioned before.
Had brought up. Yeah, he was very fluid, and I thought his answer on immigration was really good for a bunch of reasons. One, look, immigration is very thorny, and that's going to get most people in the Democratic Party. It's going to be easy to just say Trump is horrible and this is terrible. The more substantive part of this debate will probably come later on down the road, partly in the primary and certainly in the general election, because there are real issues as to what substantively you're actually going to do with. Is it 10,000 people? Is it 20,000? Is it 10 million? How do you deal with this? And it's a larger geopolitical issue. But what was really smart about him is it's easy to sort of talk about how heartbreaking the photos are and what's going on, but he was also able to pair that with policy. And you saw with Beto just continually just kind of blathers on, and he went right at him, which I thought was smart. And he had a very specific thing. He goes, we need to decriminalize this. That will take care of some of it. And he really dominated that section.
He named the legal code. He was very fluent. Yeah. And Beto had a pattern last night where he would mention somebody's name that he had met on the trail or mention a specific town in Iowa.
Yeah.
And it normally is the pattern that folks use on the stump to sort of, you know, connect with the community that you're in.
Yeah.
But on that stage, it rang hollow to me.
It didn't work. It sounded like he was like Studs Terkel trying to do an oral history of his campaign so far. And I was like, what is he doing here? No, it just didn't work with Beto. And I think one of the other issues that he's had, and I've seen this multiple times, and I complained to my friends, he was on The View a few weeks ago, and he just was like letting Meghan McCain pound him. If you're going to be the president of the United States, you can't just sit there. He has this weird hangdog kind of look sometimes. He puts his head down. He'd almost like he's apologetic. Why is de Blasio yelling at me? Why is Castro yelling at me? And you're going to have to show – if you watch someone like Warren, she's enormously confident in what she's trying to do. Klobuchar was very confident in what she's trying to do. I thought Booker came across as pretty confident. And Castro, again, I don't think people saw that side of him, and they were like, wow, okay. And Beto just has this very odd kind of recessive quality. And once someone sort of hits him, he just kind of starts looking around and be like, hey, I'm sorry. His first kind of instinct is kind of either to apologize or kind of walk, you know, into
even
the
physicality, I think, it's, you know, it's a tall guy kind of slouching on that stage. And it came off, disappointing, I think, from the caliber of candidate that we thought he would be coming in. When I look at, other candidates on that stage that maybe wouldn't normally have gotten much attention, Tim Ryan from Ohio, Congressman Tim Ryan, not polling well, probably a very long shot candidate. But I do think that this point is something I want to get Sean Walsh's opinion on. When Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, he pivoted away from this question about climate change because he didn't, you know, he wanted to get this other point in about the Democratic Party in general.
We could talk about climate, we could talk about guns, we could talk about all of these issues that we all care about. We have a perception problem with the Democratic Party. We are not connecting to the working class people in the very states that I represent, in Ohio, in the industrial Midwest. We've lost all connection. That we have got to change the center of gravity of the Democratic Party from being coastal and elitist and Ivy League, which is the perception, to somebody from the forgotten communities that have been left behind for the last 30 years, to get those workers back on our side so we can say we're going to build electric vehicles, we're going to build solar panels. But if you want to beat Mitch McConnell, this better be a working class party if you want to go into Kentucky and take his rear end out. And if you want to take Lindsey Graham out, you got to have a blue collar party that can go into the textile communities in South Carolina.
Sean T. Walsh, is he hitting the nail on the head for you in terms of the challenge for Democrats in swing states?
I think he's spot on. And he got very little attention. I also think this is, if you look very closely tonight, it's going to be interesting to see how Joe Biden navigates this particular approach when he's head to head with Bernie Sanders. But three issues that I think Ryan raised insofar as what was dominating the debate last night. You talked about the economy, and there was pretty much an attack on job creators, large companies that employ people. You saw a heavy emphasis on immigration. Talked a lot about people that are not here legally in the country. Very, very little about people from Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan that actually cost Hillary Clinton the election in the last cycle.
Amy Klobuchar did try to bring that in. Klobuchar, you know, tried to talk about her uncle that hunts, things like that.
Yeah, it was the Dickey Flats, Texas spiel, and her approach is if she can do well in Iowa because it's next door, that's her political vehicle forward. And then you got the last issue where you talk about eliminating private insurance. So okay, maybe there are 10 million or tens of millions of people who it's not working for, but there are 180 million other Americans that have private insurance, and it's working pretty well for them. So I think the Democrats really, if you read below the surface, went fairly well left, and they ignored a huge section of what Mr. Ryan was talking about, the more conservative Democrats in the Midwest and other states. So,
I'm running out of time here, and I do. We're going to have you back tomorrow to parse out what happens tonight in Miami. Again, Matt Rodriguez was also with us. That was Sean T. Walsh with Wilson Walsh Consulting. Matt Rodriguez with Rodriguez Strategies. But Amanda Renteria will not be able to be back with us tomorrow. So I do want to get your take, Amanda. Looking ahead, Joe Biden on the stage with Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg, Gillibrand, Michael Bennett. I mean, Hickenlooper. There's so many folks that will be there and some outliers like Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson. What is your expectation and hopes to hear from these candidates tonight?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a really interesting discussion tonight because they just saw what happened. And I think folks coming onto the stage are going to be more fired up, but also there's more expectation in this next panel. And so I have to say the diversity of the conversation was really something the Democratic Party, and I would argue either party, has never seen, having three women, having an African-American man, a Latino man, talk about the issues and their perspectives and all parts of the country. I think you're going to see that again. And I think it's going to be more intense tonight because the expectations are higher.
Were you happy with the amount of policy, Amanda? I'm particularly thinking about, you know, hitting that healthcare and immigration to a real granular level. Was that heartening to you about the future of this, the way this campaign's going to run going forward?
I think it's the reality of how early we are and how many people are on the stage. And also, as I just said, the diversity of what people bring to the conversation. And so it's not surprising to me it was as broad as it was, but as time goes on, you're going to see these conversations shorten, tighten, and really people move around. Where are we as a party moving together? So as I look...
Yeah, sorry, we're just about out of time. Amanda Renteria, president of Emerge America. Matt Rodriguez with Rodriguez Strategies, Sean T. Walsh with Wilson Walsh Consulting, and Mitchell McKinney at the University of Missouri. Thanks to my panelists who broke down the debate. And many will be back tomorrow to go through round two. We are just halfway through with this first debate. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Thank you for listening to Air Talk. While Larry Mantle is on vacation, I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in his seat today. The Supreme Court has blocked a citizenship question from going on the 2020 census for now. The justices said it is constitutional to ask people if they are American citizens on the census, but the Commerce Department has to come up with a better reason for it. The Wilbur Ross justification that was put forward was to enforce the Voting Rights Act, and the justices in their majority decision this morning simply said they don't buy that. Now it appears to be a race, really, between administrative procedure and printing deadlines, as the Commerce Department will likely come back and come up with a more robust reason to add a citizenship question, that is. And the printing deadline that has been put forward by the agency that distributes the census was July 1st. So assuming that the Commerce Department and the legal system cannot work fast enough, we are thinking right now that it might mean that there is not a citizenship question on the 2020 census. But again, this is a very fluid situation. We've been following it all morning since the justices came out with their decision. And we want to talk about what it means for Southern California. On the line with me now is Anne Le, 2020 Census Statewide Network Manager for Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Los Angeles. And it is a confusing maze to walk through this ruling from the Supreme Court today, but can you give me your reaction and the Los Angeles community's reaction to hearing that, at least for now, the question will not be on the census?
Yes, thank you for having me on the program. So obviously we are relieved that this decision came out. We actually were feeling a lot of the pressures of the possibility that the question would be on the form, because we did know that that was going to deter participation from a lot of our immigrant communities in Los Angeles and in all of California. We do make up a significant part of the Asian American populations across the country. So California is has the largest Asian American concentration of in the country, as well as Pacific Islander communities as well. So we were hearing from our communities that this was going to be a deterrent, and so now that the question is off, it looks like the question will be excluded from the form. We do feel like it puts us in a better position to encourage folks to participate in the census.
Has damage already been done, however, in terms of trust with the census because of the conversations and the high-profile battle that's been waged between the Trump administration and advocates who were saying this would suppress turnout? Is there already a trust issue that it will be difficult to bridge?
Yes, absolutely. That is something that we already feared would happen, just by even suggesting the question, that the damage has already been done. We did see that there was a study conducted by PIC that indicated that 59% of Asian Americans in California were suspicious about the administration maintaining confidentiality of their responses. And so that's going to be a big hurdle for us to overcome.
Yeah. Also on the line with us is Diana Collin, Director of Civic Engagement for Coalition at the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. That's CHURLA. And Diana Collin is on the line with me. What is your reaction, Diana, as we see the rather confusing ruling from the court this morning, but again, a feeling of this is a reprieve for now from having the citizenship question on the census?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. And thank you for having me as well. I think two things. The first one is this administration has done different things to weaponize the census. Different things to harm our community and make sure our community is not counted. The citizenship question is one of them. Cutting the resources that the Census Bureau has to do the field work and the field outreach is the second part. And then the third thing is making the census form online, which we know a lot of our community either doesn't have a computer, doesn't have access to broadband, or just doesn't understand or wouldn't understand how to complete the form. And so it's one thing after another that's been happening. And so, you know, with today's decision, I think it reemphasizes what we as an immigrant rights organization have been saying, that with or without a citizenship question, we are making ourselves counted because we can't afford not to. And so we have a campaign, it's called Contamos Contigo, We Count on You. And when we're asking immigrants and refugees and Latinos to commit themselves that no matter what, at the end of the day, when they get the form in the mail, they have to count every single person in their household.
What are the consequences? Lay them out for us if there's an undercount in California, Deanna.
Yeah. In California, 49% of the people in California are either immigrants or children of immigrants. So this is huge. We're talking about mixed status families. We're not just talking about the undocumented immigrant population, but people with a residency status or a TPS or a DACA status. That's what it means to not be a U.S. citizen, right? There's a whole lot of other statuses that you can have in regards to immigration. And so for us to be targeted at 49% of the people in California, aside from the resources that the state is going to get, it's about $7,000 to $8,000 per person that we get that's counted in the census. Besides that, it's the political power that we've been building, right? And as an immigrant rights organization, I'll give you the perfect example. We had a historic vote a couple weeks ago for H.R. 6, a DREAM Act vote in the House. We were able to get just about every single Democrat in the state to vote in favor of this DREAM Act legislation that will give DACA recipients and beyond and TPS holders a pathway to citizenship. And so losing these seats in the House as a blue state, as California, can definitely hurt us politically.
Ann Lett is also on the line, 2020 Census Statewide Network Manager for Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Los Angeles. A question about your method for doing outreach with the Asian American community, Ann Lett. When we talk about how diverse that is in Southern California, so many languages spoken, what are your strategies for reaching so many different communities?
Yeah, so we received a contract with the state to conduct outreach to Asian American and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander communities across the state. And, you know, the Census Bureau's in-language program is going to be limited to only 5 Asian languages. And there will be additional languages, but among the Asian languages, there will only be 5. And so our concern is that the other communities that have much higher limited English proficiency rates and are considered a significant part of the hard-to-count populations will be ignored. And so our part of our program will be producing in-language materials that are culturally and linguistically sensitive that will, you know, be used to motivate these harder-to-count populations that, you know, tend to be ignored by programs that will focus on larger communities. So that's going to be one major component of our work. Another is training our community partners or the organizations that work directly with these hard-to-count communities to be equipped with the resources and the information that they need to use, you know, appropriate messaging that will motivate community members to participate. And, you know, continuing to emphasize the need for participation to ensure that we will get our fair share of the resources and political representation for our communities. And then the third component of our work will be really engaging with ethnic media outlets that are trusted messengers within our communities so that, you know, they work with us to make sure that there's no misinformation that's being spread. And that there's that people have all of the truthful information on why to participate and you know what it will mean for our communities. And you know a lot of this is going to rely on working with trusted messengers, and that so that can mean it can mean people who are you know religious figures or you know the people that run the local store that you know our community members go to for all sorts of social services and information about what's important for their communities.
Deanna Colleen, who's here from Churla, I want to know more about the way candidates for office will be communicating about this. Have you had conversations with potential 2020 candidates about the way that as they're campaigning in these communities, there's already micro-targeting going on for communities to support individual candidates? Will they also be messaging about the importance of the census?
Yes, and with our sister organization, Trilla Action Fund, which is the one that actually engages the most with candidates, in every briefing, in every roundtable, that's one of the key and priority messagings, right? What are you going to do in your role right now to make sure our people are counted? And what are you doing? What are you doing in the local, state, national level, whatever it is your role is, to assure that people are getting the right information? And so a lot of the candidates that are now running do have elected official positions, right? And so they do have some power of, like, in regards to resources, in regards to the media spotlight and the followers to be able to amplify that message.
Do we know what happens, Deanna, if somebody just decides, I'm going to answer the rest of the questions on this census form, but not the citizenship question? That's a question that we got over Facebook from a listener, John. If somebody answering the census just skips something?
Yeah. As of now, it's a lot of unknowns. We know that since you will be able to, or have to, fill out the form online, it will allow you to move forward as long as you put in your name and your address. Like, those are the two requirements that we know for now. So the latest we heard from the Census Bureau is that it will allow you to move on to the next question.
Is that something that you're going to be messaging on? Is that something that will be brought up and explained that you can skip one?
Yeah. So right now, and again, we launched our campaign in April of this year, and it's all education. It's telling people the importance about filling out the census form, the resources that come into your community if you fill it out, and why it's important for us to be counted. The form doesn't get to people's mailboxes till next March. And by then, we will have the exact wording and the exact language and the exact questions that will be part of it, and also the exact process, right? We will know if it is finalized, that it will let you move on. But right now, it's a lot of speculation. You're just not comfortable giving people that information. So again, it's just focusing on the importance of the census and making yourself count.
Sure. That's Deanna Colleen with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. Also with me is Anne Le, 2020 Census Statewide Network Manager for Asian Americans Advancing Justice. We're discussing this major set of Supreme Court rulings that came out today, specifically the choice by the justices to say we're not going to block a citizenship question on the 2020 census right now. We are going to say that the Commerce Department needs to find a better justification than what they came up with, which was enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. The justices simply didn't seem to buy that. In the meantime, printing deadlines are approaching. July 1st was the initial printing deadline for forms for the census. And so right now, we believe that there will not be a citizenship question on that 2020 census because there's simply not enough time for the Commerce Department to go back, find a new justification, and then work its way through the courts in order to approve it. That is not final, that we still have a lot of questions about the mechanics of the way the census will roll out, about whether that printing deadline is official. So that's why we're saying for now, it appears that the courts have blocked the citizenship question. More to come on this story, certainly. In the meantime, Anne Le, when you message to your communities in Southern California, Asian Americans, there has to be a historical context weighing heavy on your mind. And that is the revelations that came out many years later about information that was used during World War II to intern Japanese Americans, right?
Yes. There are many hurdles that we're facing with every census. And a big part of that is because of the history of the Census Bureau using that information against Japanese Americans during World War II. I think one of the things that we really do need to emphasize with our communities is that after that happened, Title 13 was passed, which strengthened confidentiality provisions that put in place very stiff penalties for the sharing of information and responses from to the Bureau.
And does that mean that when you message, Do you acknowledge that and say that there are simply way more penalties now? It doesn't happen anymore. I mean, how it is just such a delicate thing to talk about because of the painful history there.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, a significant percentage of the new immigrants that have come over since the last census are from Asian countries. And so I think that, you know, if we were to share information just off the, you know, out the gate about the pernicious uses of the citizenship data with folks that, you know, didn't have that context, then it would definitely, you know, promote more fear. And so obviously we would need to fine tune our messages based off of who the audience is, because each of our ethnicities are very distinct and diverse. And so I think for some communities like the Japanese American community, or, you know, even some communities that bore witness to what happened, we would definitely bring that up or offer that information if the questions are asked of us. But I think for some of the communities with a lot more newer immigrant populations, we would focus more on confidentiality provisions and emphasize the importance of the census on our communities and our future.
That's Anne Le, 2020 Census statewide manager for the Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles chapter. Deanna Colleen, also with us from CHRLA. Just really quickly, Deanna, how closely will you be following as this whole situation unfolds, whether or not the Commerce Department will attempt to challenge and get a question snuck in here, you know, under the wire as the printing goes forward on these census forms? Looks like we lost Deanna. Anne Le, do you want to react to that? How closely are you watching it, you know, whether or not the Commerce Department will challenge?
Oh, yeah. No, we're vigilantly watching over this. I mean, with this administration, everything is anything is possible, right? And so if anything were to happen with the census at all, we have civil rights attorneys that will continue to fight the question in the courts and fight any other obstacles that they try to put our way.
Thanks so much to my guests. Coming up, we're going to talk about a potential grocery strike in supermarkets around Southern California. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. Back after this short break. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle while he takes a vacation. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York City, and also the legacy of LGBT activism in Southern California and the famous protest that predates Stonewall in Los Angeles, right there in Silver Lake at the Black Cat. Just in a few minutes, if you have memories of the history of LGBT activism nationwide, Stonewall, or right here in LA, you are very welcome to join our conversation at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. But right now, we are all looking at our grocery bags and wondering if they're still going to be filled and ready for us going into a holiday weekend, because there is talk now about a potential grocery workers' strike again in Southern California. Of course, our area was once home to the largest and longest grocery workers' strike in American history. That was 16 years ago when employees of Albertsons, Vaughn's, Pavilions, and Ralph's walked off the job, and it lasted over 4 months. Our next guest covered that story back then, and he is here to talk about what conditions could happen to present that again. James Peltz is on the line, business writer for the Los Angeles Times. Again, covered the strike in 03 and 04, and he's following it, the potential for a strike right now. He tweets at PELTZ LA Times. Welcome, James. Can you bring us back to 03, 04? What was it like out there, and how did it affect workers and consumers to be on such a long strike?
Oh, good morning. Yes, for those who either weren't living in Southern California at the time or too young to remember, it was enormously disruptive. The chains that you mentioned, I mean, the major chains, Albertsons, Ralph's, Vaughn's, you know, had sort of a larger share of the market back then. And when all of this happened, it was in October when there was a strike against one of the chains and the others then locked out their workers in solidarity. And it was in October, and the feeling at the time was this might go on for a couple of weeks, but there was no way each side was going to let this continue through Thanksgiving, which, as we all know, is a huge time for us to be shopping for food and whatnot. It blew right through Thanksgiving, it went right through Christmas, and it went right through the New Year, and it just dragged on. And one of the things that was fascinating about it was, you know, people in the grocery business will tell you that we're all creatures of habit when it comes to grocery shopping. We tend to go to the same stores out of convenience or out of because we like them so much. We even tend to walk up and down the aisles the same way every time we go to a grocery store. And what that disruption 16 years ago caused was suddenly millions of people in Southern California were forced or decided to go to, they didn't want to cross the picket line, so they decided to try other places, whether it was Costco, whether it was Trader Joe's, whether it was Gelson's, you name it, where they hadn't been before. And what they found is that over an extended period of time, they actually liked these places, and they moved a good deal of their business. In fact, if I recall correctly, there was a dislocation of something like 10% of the traffic to the stores that were involved in the dispute went somewhere else.
Oh, that's a huge disruption, I mean, and a huge loss of business for those supermarket chains. It's fascinating. How was it resolved?
They lost about $1.5 billion in sales over those 4 months the chains were involved in the dispute, and a good portion of that never came back, only in the sense that people then decided, hey, you know, this isn't so bad, I'll try these other places and continue to shop there, at least part-time. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you can't go to a Trader Joe's and buy all of the things that you normally would get, say, at Ralph's.
But this is true. And, you know, the produce selection, the butcher selection, everything is different at different stores. What was the ultimate resolution there on the strike of 03-04, James? And then we want to get over to what's happening today.
Well, the ultimate resolution was that the union, what the supermarkets wanted was a two-tier system. Keep in mind, supermarket workers not only get wages, but they tend to get health care benefits and pension benefits, depending on how long you've been there and so forth, which is pretty unusual these days, and we'll get to that, when you're talking about a job where a lot of the entry-level positions are just at the minimum wage. Anyway, the point is that back then, they settled it by creating a two-tier system where new hires would get less than people who had already been working there. That's a broad brush, but essentially that's what happened. Now, the two-tier wages actually went away in later contracts. They've had three or four contracts since then, but it still exists to some extent in the healthcare and pension side of things.
And in this contract negotiation that's currently going on, and this is the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Southern and Central California, and they're negotiating now with Albertsons and Ralph's, because I guess Albertsons owns a few of those chains now, that Vons and Pavilions, right? So now there are fewer grocery chains to negotiate with. What's the topic of contention right now?
A lot of the same thing. I mean, the primary issue is wages. The supermarket or the union claims that the supermarkets are only offering something like 1% or less a year in pay raises. It would be a three-year contract again. And they contend that they're only offering 1% or less a year in a pay increase over the life of the contract. We haven't heard from the supermarkets in terms of the details of what they're offering, and they haven't really countered what the union is claiming, but that's the primary complaint from the union. And the other thing to keep in mind is, if you look, they're still operating with the contract that expired in March. And if you look at the pay scales of that, the contract called for a lot of these workers to be paid what is now less than the minimum wage here in Los Angeles. And so the union is, if nothing else, is trying to stay above the minimum wage. I mean, for example, I think in a couple of days on July 1st, the minimum wage in Los Angeles goes up to $14.25 an hour,
which is higher than that low end of what the union contract is right now.
That's correct. And you know, and then now in the state of California, the minimum wage is still $12. So it depends on where you live. But their point is that in terms of trying to pay these workers, you know, a cost of living wage, it should be much higher. Naturally, that's what they would want.
Yeah, James Peltz, business writer for the Los Angeles Times, who followed the strike, large grocery strike in 2003 and 04, stretched over the holidays, very disruptive to shoppers and really permanently changed shopping patterns, as James reports. You can follow him at PELTZLA Times on Twitter. Really great follow to keep up on this grocery strike. So now there has been an authorization vote. Do I understand that correctly? What is the status right now with these negotiations?
Right. I wouldn't expect anything to happen in the near term, meaning in the next few weeks. This simply gives the union the authorization to call a strike if they want to. And it puts more bargaining pressure on the supermarkets because now they know the workers are prepared to go if it came to that. But they're planning to resume the negotiations, I think, on July 10th or so, and we'll see what happens. This is very similar to what happened 16 years ago where the talks continued and then completely fell apart in the fall, probably not by accident, just ahead of the holidays. So I wouldn't expect anything immediately. But one thing to keep in mind, too, is that we were talking earlier about how the dislocation that occurred 16 years ago, and now the market, by the way, Southern California is the largest grocery market in the country, something like $45 billion a year in sales. I mean, now it's a whole lot different. I think a lot more people are accustomed to shopping at Costco or Trader Joe's or Gelson's or at their ethnic market. There are so many like Latino markets and others that are around now, Stater Brothers, particularly in the Inland Empire. So I think people are a lot more accustomed to, and by the way, also we've had the a couple of chains have now come into the market, such as the German discount chain Aldi and Grocery Outlet and some of these others.
And Target carries groceries, as you point out in your story.
Out of my mouth, the grocery aisles at Target and at Walmart are huge. So there are plenty of places now that people could go if it came to that. But there's no discounting what a disruption, another disruption would cost, because Ralph's and Albertsons/Vons still have 40% of the Southern California market. It's a big deal.
So we are just watching to see as these negotiations go forward. You're saying it's probably not anytime soon, not like before the 4th of July holiday or anything. Any predictions going forward, James, in our last minute here? What do you think is going to happen?
I think they'll probably find a settlement. I don't think either side, having been through that, I don't think either side wants to see something like that again. So my best speculation is that they'll strike an agreement before anybody walks out.
James Peltz, business writer for the Los Angeles Times, following this story closely of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Southern and Central California, negotiating with Albertsons and Ralph's. Shadows of a story that James covered closely in 03 and 04 when that big grocery worker strike stretched over the holidays, very disruptive to people's daily lives and shopping habits. James, thanks very much for being on Air Talk.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle. Coming up in just a couple of minutes after the news, we're going to hear some firsthand accounts of activism for LGBT rights in the Los Angeles area. And at the same time, look back at the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York. You can also share your memories of what Stonewall meant to you or your memories of activism in Los Angeles. If you call 866-893-5722, you can also go on our social media or our AirTalk page on kbcc.org. We'll be back after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Thanks for listening to AirTalk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle all week. One more day for me tomorrow, and then Larry will be back on Monday. And I hope he tells you all about his amazing travels. He's been having a great vacation. We got a postcard here at the AirTalk studios that he sent in from his family. Congratulations to Larry on that great vacation. Well, it was an early morning on June 28th in 1969, and the stage was a dive bar in Greenwich Village in New York City. The protest that what happened there sparked is credited with launching the gay rights movement and inspiring modern pride celebrations. This Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. But that series of protests in New York wasn't the first demonstration in the gay rights movement. Los Angeles played an important role as well. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. In the meantime, to talk about the legacy of Stonewall, Lillian Faderman is on the line. She's in studio, actually, with me right here, and not even on the line, came right in person. She's the author and historian who specializes in lesbian and LGBT history, and she tweets at Lillian Faderman on Twitter. Again, two L's in her name. Welcome, Lillian, and I'm curious, when you think about what happened at Stonewall, it's not as though police raids were uncommon in New York or in major cities across the country. What made that night different?
There had been at least five police raids in the 2 weeks before Stonewall. But what happened that night that was unusual is that the police came in, raided the place, asked to see people's IDs. They let some people go. Usually in a raid, what would happen if somebody was let go? They would run. They would be so happy they got out of there. This time, the people who were let go didn't run. They stood outside waiting for their friends to join them. It became a critical mass. A lesbian was brought out by the police, put into the police car. She got out the other door. They ran around the other door, put her in again. She got out the other door, and she yelled to the crowd, "Why don't you guys do something?" And the story is that that was when someone threw the first stone, and that was the beginning of the Stonewall riots. But you ask what made that night unusual and what made that possible. I think what really made it possible was the 1960s. Everything that led up to the Stonewall riots. This was, after all, practically the tail end of the 1960s. It was the end of June. It was 1969. There had been what was called in those days black demonstrations and black riots. Practically every summer there was a black riot. This was the era of the anti-Vietnam War protests, and there were huge demonstrations and huge riots connected to that. This was the era of the feminist protests, and there weren't riots, but there were huge demonstrations. And I think all of these young people who participated in the riots had been used to just watching this stuff on their living room on the television every night. And I think it was just an idea whose time had come. It was time for the gay community to stand up and say, we've had it, we're angry, and we want some changes.
And just set the stage for how that environment was different than today, because I think it's hard for people who were born. I was born in the 1980s. I remember a different era of the way we treated and thought about gay people. But I don't remember the kind of discrimination that was occurring in the 60s. Can you set a stage for what that treatment was like?
Everywhere we turned in the 1960s, there was discrimination. To the churches and synagogues, and there were practically no exceptions. We were all sinners. To the so-called mental health profession, we were all crazies. To the law, we were all criminals. Even to the federal government, we were subversives because it was feared that if we had a government job, we were so blackmailable because homosexuality was so terrible that somehow we would betray the country. So there was really nowhere gay people could turn outside of the bars and the gay community that existed and feel that we were accepted and understood.
So the brick or the shot glass, as the fable may go, was thrown at Stonewall. Do you have a take, by the way, on who threw the first brick? I know it's controversial. who threw it?
You know, it sort of doesn't matter. I think that at least emotionally everyone did. I think that the gay community was just so ready to make our feelings known.
Yeah.
And so the particular person really does not matter.
The stories that I've seen, you know, they vary from a drag queen to, you know, the same lesbian who had been protesting. I mean, there's many, many different ways that people have read the history. So as these protests are unfolding on the streets of New York, How does that connect with today's pride celebrations, legal fights for gay rights? How does that evolve just from this one protest, this one riot based on a police raid in New York?
Yeah, I think that despite the fact that the riot actually went on for 4 nights, it could easily have been forgotten. The New York Times covered it on page 33, saying that policemen were hurt in a village melee, and that was it. The New York Daily News covered it with just this terrible headline saying, "Homo nest raided, queen bees are stinging mad." And that was the extent of the coverage, except in the very incipient gay press. Mattachine, New York, had a newsletter, and the writer of one article in Mattachine, New York, called the riots the hairpin drop heard round the world. Hmm. Obviously a campy reference to the gay guys who were rioting. And the Los Angeles Advocate had just begun a couple of years before. It was still a local newspaper. Now, of course, it's a large lesbian and gay and trans and bi magazine. But the Los Angeles Advocate covered it and said that this was important. But outside of that, there was no coverage. But what happened almost immediately after the riots is that a group of young people got together. Mattachine had tried to organize them, but they broke off from Mattachine, which was a fairly conservative homophile organization. They started a group called the Gay Liberation Front. And just the name itself in the 1960s was so catchy that Gay Liberation Front spread all over the country, including Los Angeles. Los Angeles, very soon after the New York Gay Liberation Front was started, we had a Gay Liberation Front here. And together with that, the New York Gay Liberation Front said, we have to commemorate the Stonewall Riots. And so 1 year from the date of the Stonewall Riots, 1970, June 28th, we're going to have a parade. And it asked other cities, gay groups in other cities, to join them. Los Angeles did. In Los Angeles, there was a fabulous parade down Hollywood Boulevard, 1,000 people participating. San Francisco had a tiny parade, and Chicago had a parade of a couple of hundred people.
Oh, wow. L.A. outdid San Francisco.
Absolutely.
Back then.
Huh? Absolutely.
That's great. Lillian Faderman, author and historian specializing in lesbian and LGBT history. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York, but we can't talk about the history of LGBT activism and the context within which Stonewall happened without recognizing its history here in Los Angeles. And we have a member of a very special group of people who were present at, you know, the organization of the initial activism at the Black Cat in Silver Lake in 1967. Alexei Romanov, who's in studio with me as well. Welcome, Alexei. And what was your role in what happened at the Black Cat? And if you could describe that night, what occurred there for me?
Well, at the Black Cat, there was not just a police raid, there was police brutality. And that is one of the things that stand out. I think it pushed us over the edge, and it made us more active. We had an organization going at the time that was called PRIDE. It was an acronym for People in Education and so on and so forth. I'm not going to go into the whole thing. But what happened that night was in the Black Cat, which has the original sign still there from that bar.
I used to live up the street from it, yeah.
Okay. And one of the things, there were police undercover officers in the Black Cat on New Year's Eve of that date, and they played Auld Lang Syne. The people there began to hug, which wasn't illegal, but two people who were there kissed, and that was illegal because what they found out afterwards, that it was a man and his sister who was masculinely dressed, and they thought it was two men kissing, and they attacked them and they beat them and they subdued them and put them down. People didn't know what was going on. And there was a great deal of brutality. There was a number of people who ended up in the hospital. Now, that continued on after the first contact there. There was a man in woman's attire, which was illegal. It was illegal. It was called costuming, and it wasn't legal that time, who looked in the bar when they saw the police beating people who were undercover police, not in uniform. When they saw them beating people, they ran back out. So the man in a white dress and his partner there, whoever it was, ran down the street to another bar that was called the New Faces on Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And the police followed them, and they ran in there, and the police came in and said to the bartender there, who is the manager or the owner here? Looking over, the bartender said, Leroy, which sounded like a man's name, L-E-E. Her name was Lee, and her last name was Roy.
That's a first and last name.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they joined, they heard it together, and they saw the white dress. And it was on the manager. She had a gown on that night. And they thought that was the person that ran down from the other bar. They grabbed her. They ruptured her collarbone that night. She ended up in the hospital. Also, a bartender there didn't know what was going on, didn't know it was the police, but saw someone beating his employer.
I mean, it must have been incredibly frightening just because we have a limited time here. How did that roll into protests on the street outside the Black Cop?
Well, they beat her and broke her collarbone. She ended up on the street face down. I have to describe what caused us to go over the edge and actually develop the...
Yeah.
She went... They took her to the hospital that night, and the bartender, they ruptured his spleen. When they pulled him over, he was coming over the bar. They grabbed him and beat him. Anyway, to get past that, a number of people were arrested and so forth. That morning, there were calls that went out. We had what we called a phone tree. And the phone tree was that 10 people called 10 people. There was no internet. There was no computers. Called 10 more people. And each group would call 10 more. And I belonged to an organization that was already in process called Pride.
Yeah. And so as those networks are reaching out to their 10 people, people are being made aware, and then they show up and very bravely. I mean, the pictures that I've seen and the reenactment that occurred last year for the Black Cat, it's just so inspiring. Who showed up? What were those protests like?
Fearful. It wasn't a Pride celebration. It was absolute terror. If you look on, I said to the chief of police, Bratton, at one point when I was meeting with him, I said, do you see anybody in that picture smiling? The only coverage we had for that demonstration was from the Free Press.
Mm.
No news media. And most of the people, believe it or not, were glad that the news media weren't covering that.
Even with all the violence. Alexei, we are just going to break very quickly. Be right back with you. Alexei Romanov, the last known member of the original Pride organization, which organized the protest at the Black Cat in Silver Lake in 1967. And also in studio with us is Lillian Faderman, author and historian specializing in LGBT history. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising in New York. And because it's Pride Month, activism that preceded that in Los Angeles, like at the Black Cat. I'm Libby Denkman, and for Larry Mantle, back after this short break. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. I'm speaking with Alexei Romanov, last known member of the original Pride organization, which set off the protest, the Black Cat protest in Silver Lake in 1967, which preceded the Stonewall Uprising. It's the 50th anniversary of Stonewall in New York. Lillian Faderman is with me right now as well, author and historian specializing in LGBT history. And you were just saying there was activism even before the Black Cat. What sort of things stick out to you?
Los Angeles was really remarkable in its early activism. The very first homophile organization, as they call themselves, started here in Los Angeles in 1950. Even before the Black Cat, there was the first nationally distributed gay magazine. That was one magazine that began in Los Angeles in 1953. Even before that, there was a locally circulated lesbian magazine called Vice Versa that began here in 1947. So there was all of this awareness of how the gay community had to organize, and it just took a while for the organizing to begin.
But. And then the Stonewall riots sort of set off this wildfire, you know, that really spreads. But as you point out, the context was all of these predecessors of activism that came before.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's important that when the first Pride parade was being organized, there was already in Los Angeles enough of an organization that they could get 1,000 people to manifest to walk down Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. That's a big illustration of that. And somebody who was present for that, Alexei Romanov, with me right now. We only have a couple minutes left, Alexei, but, you know, you talked with me on the break about the fear that those protesters were feeling. Can you describe that?
The fear they were feeling was that they would be outed. Here's people demonstrating. They were afraid that people would know that they were homosexuals. Now, it wasn't just homosexuals. It was gay men and gay women, as we called them at that time, and those who support us. So everybody in those pictures are not homosexuals. There were straight people who supported our movement and belong to our organizations.
What do you think today, Alexei, when you see people being able to be out and successful in professional life and in media, what are your emotions living through and being part of this activism, you know, throughout the years, throughout the decades, to see what progress has been made today?
Not as quite as much, but what would the black people feel after liberation of the Civil War? It's a similar feeling, but also it's a pride. And not just using that term lightly, it's a pride that we have come this far because of the people who have fought before me and after me. I had a mentor when I was really young, at 14 years old. I only know him to this day by the words Mother Brian, a term of endearment. And that man, we used to go up to Bryant Park on 42nd Street and 6th Avenue behind the museum and sit there, and he would tell us what it was like to be gay in 1890 when he was 20.
Oh, Alexei, I'm so sorry that we're running out of time, but I want to continue this conversation very soon because it's so powerful. Alexei Romanov and Lillian Faderman, remembering the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Thank you.